today on Against the Grain? What if Earth were furious with humanity? And what if revolutionaries took their cues from a rebellious, unruly planet? I'm CS. We'll revisit a conversation with Anne Stewart about her book, Angry Planet, Decolonial Fiction and the American Third World, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Planet Earth is often portrayed as a victim, as victimized by irresponsible and rapacious human activity. But what if the planet weren't, or weren't only, something that is acted upon? What if Earth were an actor in its own right? What if planetary motion and upheaval were an expression of rage? Of rageful rejection of settler colonial and capitalist business as usual. In the work of writers like Octavia Butler and Leslie Marmon Silko, Anne Stewart sees representations of an angry planet alongside stories of angry people deciding enough is enough. We must begin anew. An alternative path must be forged. Anne Stewart teaches in the College of Liberal Arts at the University of British Columbia. Her book is Angry Planet, Decolonial Fiction and the American Third World. When Anne and I connected recently, I asked how she came up with the idea for this book.
I was, you know, engaging very closely with American fiction written in the 1980s and 1990s, and I was kind of taken by how much of the material resonated with a lot of the concerns that were at the forefront of and came to the forefront of a lot of political and cultural reckoning over the last decade. So questions of decolonization, but also making the connections between conditions of racial violence and environmental violence. And the way that people were bringing these things together and into the public consciousness, you know, over the last decade or so, really mapped well, had these amazing connections with what so many of these authors were talking about in the 1990s. And so I was really motivated as I started to develop Angry Planet to create a bridge between the political imagination that I was seeing in these novels and what's happening in our world today. And it was amazing to me just how many authors writing in the US at the end of the 20th century were thinking about the not only the connections between the persistence of racial oppression, violence, inequality, and its connection to climate change, to environmental ruin, but how these things were connected through their rootedness in the history of settler colonialism in so-called North America. So it was all about a kind of an almost remember the 90s project, but not in a joking way, in a like, we need to think about the roots of so much of the thought that is prevalent today.
So the 10 novels that you discuss in your book, is there a way to generalize about the way in which the land is represented?
I love that question because that is also kind of where a lot of the thinking that structures this project comes from, because all of these novels, they're by authors writing from different parts of the country, different ethnic backgrounds, different political commitments. And what makes them so conversant with each other is the way that they are thinking about their relationship to land and to the planet in very, very similar ways. And so they're all seeing, you know, first of all, the planet as this furious sort of writhing, raging entity, which is quite different from the way that we think today about the planet sort of under the sign of the Anthropocene as this, you know, beaten down, subjugated thing that human activity has destroyed, versus thinking of it as they all are, as something that is fighting back at climate change, as expressing a kind of environmental fury. And so all the novels share this, and this is something you read in, you know, they say, they call the earth angry, furious, writhing, seething. And from that shared understanding of the planet as this entity that is angry with the way that it is being used by human activity, all the authors, and this goes for the, you know, indigenous authors in the project, like Gerald Visner and Leslie Marmon Silko, but also authors writing from different backgrounds, different ethnic and cultural backgrounds, John Edgar Wideman, Thomas Pynchon, Octavia Butler, they all realize that the root of this planetary fury begins with colonial incursion into the continent, the way that the history of settler colonialism supports the flourishing of the capitalist mode of production, and the way that these modes of production and organizing human life have created this state of planetary destruction.
Is there some way in which these novels have convinced you, or you think have convinced readers, that the planet is truly angry? It has an affective aspect to it such that it will express itself in furious ways, in ways that often in these novels sort of upturn human settlements and destroy infrastructures and the like?
When I think about the concept of the angry planet, as I said, it very much comes from the language that these authors use. And it calls to mind for me language, you know, that we use like a raging river, right? We don't necessarily mean that the river is full of rage, but that, yeah, it does have this affective valence of pushing back, rejecting, being dissatisfied or upset, not in a human way, because there is a kind of, as I discuss extensively in the project, there's also a supreme indifference to this fury. But the anger, quote unquote, that the planet evinces across these texts is something that we can see too in the world around us, reflects many of the emotions, of the feelings of the communities and people in these novels that feel their own struggles as aligned with those of the earth. So when in a lot of these novels, there is a dispossessed community of some kind, usually a poor community of color living on the margins of the nation state, that seeks to change conditions, call the state to account in some way, and finds allyship with the angry earth, and sees in the motion of earthquakes, of tidal waves, of infrastructural disasters, the sense that there is a desire, and again, I don't mean a desire in a totally human sense, but more like a movement, I guess movement is a good way to think of it, a movement toward wanting to overturn the infrastructural conditions of settler state power that create so much partitioned, racialized human misery. So when I think about the earth as an angry entity in this sense, I think about the way that these authors are trying to convey that allyship between the angry people and the angry planet.
So would it be fair to say, Anne, that let's say the people in Silko's Almanac of the Dead, and we'll talk about that in some detail, take their cues from earthly phenomena, find their model in earthly conduct? What phraseology or ways of expressing it do you like?
Something I often say in this regard is that in these novels, planetary motion is a prompt to decolonial thought. So the authors of these novels are trying to say, like, the Earth is telling us that the situation, the entire organization of human life on the planet needs to be rethought, needs to be reimagined and reconfigured in really fundamental ways. And the communities that are prompted into revolutionary action, for example, in these novels, are very much driven by hearing that or understanding that from their relationship to the Earth. In, for example, one of the books I write about, John Edgar Wideman's Philadelphia Fire, he's writing about a real historical event in that novel, the bombing of the Move House in Philadelphia. And the way he writes that community as critiquing the position of Black Philadelphians in the city, in the state more broadly, and drawing that critique from their relationship to the Earth that they understand as not wanting to be paved over with concrete, you know, not wanting them to live in ways that reject the connection to land and earth, not wanting them to live in ways where, you know, for example, racial belonging, as it is in the 1980s, is this very, class qualified thing. Like, rejecting all of these ideas and how that thinking comes directly from their listening to the land, paying attention to how it's moving, to how it's, you know, existing in this sort of shattered, damaged state. The consistency with which the authors across these texts make those exact connections is amazing. And it absolutely, I think, shows across the board, like, how many people were thinking about, well, if we pay attention to how the land is reacting to the force of the colonial capitalist extractive state, and how often land seems to reject and rebel against these conditions, those lead us to different ways of thinking about our relationship to the Earth. And I draw heavily in this theorization on the Indigenous legal scholar Glenshawn Coulthard's concept of grounded normativity, which he defines as a set of reciprocal relations and understandings of how the world works, how we should, as humans, exist in the world by listening, by paying attention to what the Earth is telling us. And, you know, this is a concept that has deep roots in a lot of Indigenous intellectual traditions. But it's amazing to see how many authors, how many thinkers were articulating this in this decade.
And Stewart joins me on Against the Grain. She is a lecturer in the College of Liberal Arts at the University of British Columbia. We are talking about her book, Angry Planet, Decolonial Fiction and the American Third World. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So, Leslie Marmon Silko's novel Almanac of the Dead comes out in 1991. What sorts of terrestrial and climatic upheaval take place in this novel? And what sorts of things unfold in it in places like Tucson, along the U.S.-Mexico border, and I guess in a mountainous region near Guatemala's border with Mexico.
It is a novel that has received a lot of criticism for its representation of human life, human relationships, human dynamics. But if you read it as a novel about how the planet works, it becomes a really different story. It becomes a story about all these different communities, all the places you were just flagging, who are thinking about tremendous environmental upheavals that are happening that, you know, are for us kind of halfway between, you know, realistic and verging on the apocalyptic. And all these communities in the novel are noticing, you know, rolling earthquakes, crazy shifts in climate, natural disasters that are challenging the state's ability to organize itself. And based on those motions, that listening to these rolling and accumulating disasters, all these disparate communities start to think about challenging the conditions in which they exist. And this goes for everything from prison abolition to extreme poverty in Tucson to the experiences of indigenous communities on reservations to, you know, neoliberal criminality impacting everything from, you know, border crossing to basic, you know, Marxist challenges to the neoliberal state. And all of these activists, and there's points in the novel where characters say things directly like, we know that a change is coming and it's going to come in the form of, you know, earthquakes and riots. And someone says, earthquakes, riots, which one is it going to be? And, you know, they say there's no difference. There's no difference between an earthquake and a riot. And so the way that Silco is thinking about human revolutionary activity and planetary terrestrial upheaval as being aligned in this novel and doing the same kind of work and bringing all these disparate resistance communities into allyship, you know, this is, I think, what makes this story so provocative. Even if sometimes when you're telling a story like that, it can be hard to kind of just write good banter, good relationships between characters. But the big picture story, you know, that the novel is telling is really what I'm interested in.
So yeah, I'm reading from your book, Angry Planet, about Silco's book, Almanac of the Dead. You've got dozens of volcanoes erupting, serial earthquakes, all the southwestern states are about to run out of drinking water, weather systems, as you said, are in chaos. The suggestion that there are a number of different, I don't know if you want to call them revolutionary bands in different locales in this novel, does it suggest, or can you talk more about how the earthly motion and earthly chaos has the possibility, perhaps, of uniting disparate communities, disparate activists, disparate people, indigenous and otherwise, struggling against things like the legacies of slavery and colonialism and capitalist exploitation?
This is one of the more complicated questions in Angry Planet, because on the one hand, straightforwardly, in Almanac and in all of these novels, we see these disparate communities coming together as they pay attention to planetary motion and to the disasters and crises that it is prompting. And we see these authors imagining how human actors gain in agency and mobility through following the agentic motions of the planet. For example, There's a scene in which a kind of Marxist army of the dispossessed is marching north and marching toward the Mexico-US border, and they're traveling by foot. And all of the military vehicles that are trying to follow them are getting caught in these earthquakes and mudslides and things that are bogging down, these titans of petrochemical state power. And by walking, right, by moving with the earth and moving over the earth, this marching army is able to sort of defeat, in a sense, these military vehicles. And this is something, this is a kind of motion and agency and mobility that is repeated through all these different communities. And so it is as they move with the earth that they converge together. And a really, really important part of the theoretical framework of the project is, not only that this is happening, that the revolutionary communities in these novels are following the motion of the earth and are coming together by following this motion, but that they are, they are correct in following this motion and in understanding it as a resistant and rebellious motion that they can be aligned with. So as they are aligned with the earth, so they become aligned with each other. So that's the dream, right? That is the imaginary of Almanac of the Dead and of a lot of, this Angry Planet fiction. Of course, on the other hand, the reality of crisis and disaster is that it helps to consolidate the power and helps to grow the capitalist state. We know well from theorists of crisis, from David Harvey to Naomi Klein, that capitalism loves a disaster because it creates surplus. It allows areas for redevelopment to happen. And so all of these authors imagining the kind of revolutionary energy and force and allyship that can come from terrible environmental disasters that in reality, hurt a lot of people, have to sort of put aside the idea that, what is actually happening here is a further consolidation of state power through crisis. But what the revolutionary communities moving together and with the earth into allyship in these stories are thinking is not that, like, oh, well, this is just going to be another, another reconsolidation of capitalist power. What they're thinking is anything is better than the current state of affairs. Anything is better than the, normalized community of excessive, poverty, depredation, racialized violence, state-funded and backed forms of political and economic and spatial dispossession. And so that is what I think ultimately kind of brings these revolutionary communities and energy together, is that, you have people who are absolutely desperate for something different, anything different than the norm as we see it at the end of the 20th century in the US.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Ann Stewart joins me. She is a settler scholar from Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, in Treaty One territory. She teaches in the College of Liberal Arts at the University of British Columbia. The book is Angry Planet, Decolonial Fiction and the American Third World. It's published by the University of Minnesota Press. So in this book, revolutionaries plan coordinated attacks on prisons, dams, power plants, and computer networks. Identity politics and class struggle are two possible foundations or rallying points for revolution, for the sorts of revolutionary activity the protagonists of this novel engage in. Does Silke wanna foreground either identity politics or class struggle?
Well, it is absolutely the case that her revolutionaries inhabit specific and very much discussed and well-defined identity and class positions. So there are, you know, very, very Marxist revolutionaries. There are indigenous revolutionaries whose, you know, revolutionary ethos is very much tied to the total rejection of capitalist state power and colonial settlement. And then there are bands of sort of mixed race, you know, multi-ethnic groups of people, veterans experiencing homelessness. And I think that for the purposes of Almanac of the Dead, I think Silke is always acutely aware of the subject and class positions that she is marking her characters under. And one of the things that I think she wants to do with that is actually show that there are so many and so diverse an array of dispossessed subjects under settler colonial state power that those experiences can't be sort of limited to one particular group or subject or class position. That being said, rich white people are definitely the absolute villains of this book. And this is another thing she's been critiqued for, is the villains in this book could not be more disgusting and despicable. And so at the same time that she is trying to imagine these solidarities that can cut across, you know, identity politics, definitely. When it comes to portraying wealthy whiteness, there is nothing that could be kind of more monstrous in this configuration. And so, yeah, there's definitely a clear sort of divide between the spatially, racially disenfranchised people of the North American continent and the monsters, the monstrous, wealthy, white characters, which the two will never meet, and there will never be kind of parity there. But other than that, she definitely wants to imagine and play out how very different categories, you know, and in fact, the novel ends in this, one of the ending scenes is everyone, a bunch of the revolutionary leaders kind of go to a conference together, you know, and they have like a good conference meeting talking about their revolutionary plans. And it's all kind of very like nicely organized and productive. So the question of identity politics in this novel is a difficult one. But I think that ultimately the dream, the vision is that when we align ourselves with the earth, that becomes a grounding for solidarity across very different subject positions.
Well, with all this revolutionary activity afoot, one would expect the state to respond in some way. You mentioned that, yeah, the vehicles of state power, the literal vehicles, get bogged down because of the earthquakes, because, you know, the terrain is difficult to traverse. But do the revolutionaries on the march, do they encounter state violence? Does it come to that?
One of the very interesting things about the works that I characterize as Angry Planet fiction is they almost all have some kind of confrontation with state power at some point in the story. And in this chapter, so the chapter where I write about Silco's Almanac of the Dead, I also write about the novel The Tattooed Soldier by Hector Tovar, which is about, it's about a lot of things, but its timeline sort of centers around the LA riots. And in both The Tattooed Soldier and in Almanac of the Dead, each novel ends the moment before state power is about to come down like a bag of hammers on the revolutionary activity happening in the story. So there is, you know, there's this kind of awful moment near the end of Almanac where one of the characters is both imagining this, you know, envisioning the potential of this amazing convergence of revolutionary energy, but also saying that they know that the state is about to kind of step in with its full fury. And this is an interesting thing about really serious decolonial movement, which is not solely about changing terms of representation or the politics of recognition, but is about, and in these novels this is certainly the case, about changing the physical shape of the world we live in. Imagining, you know, wanting to go so far as to imagine, you know, what if we just burned this city to the ground and built something different? What if we completely changed the way that we organize and run every aspect of social order? And when, you know, you forward that extreme form of decolonial imaginary or futurism, which is a very extreme materialist argument, these novels say, you know, you are going to be met with the full fury of state power. And in the previous chapter, which is about Philadelphia Fire and Kerente Yamashita's novel, Tropic of Orange, that is actually, you know, both those stories, those revolutionary stories, end with the state essentially firebombing the revolutionary communities in those stories. And in this chapter, we just arrive at kind of the moment before that happens. And that is very interesting to me, because one thing about Angry Planet fiction is it's something of a failed imaginary. It's about trying to see climate change as people were first perceiving it in the, you know, the 80s and 90s, as something that was going to necessarily lead to a revolutionary transformation of the world. And so all of these authors are imagining this, but, you know, by the time we get into the 21st century, this has become like, oh no, we know about climate change, but nothing is going to happen. Nothing is actually going to be transformed, right? But these authors, they believe in this imaginary so much and so passionately, but they also have trouble imagining their way into that future. So all of these stories kind of end either with the state sort of reconsolidating its power over these revolutionary communities, or with sort of the moment before something happens. You know, like, they have trouble imagining beyond that moment.
We move to another of the novels you discuss in some detail in this book, Angry Planet, Octavia Butler's 1993 novel, Parable of the Sower, also involves a lot of terrestrial upheaval and mayhem. We've got water shortages, extreme weather events, seismic activity, and we have a gated community in which Lauren Olamina lives with her family at the beginning of the novel. So as a result of all this mayhem, civil order in the U.S. breaks down, people are fleeing their homes. What should we know about the community in which Lauren lives, and what happens to people in it?
So when we are introduced to Lauren Olamina and her family and the gated community that they live in, we get this very interesting take, I think, from Butler on the kind of mixed bag of spatial politics that this novel brings to its engagement with land use and property ownership. Because I think most people who have done some thinking about gated communities and, you know, critical geography to some degree, have a pretty strong sense that gated communities represent some pretty bad spatial politics. And those very much surround the need to keep the world out, protect one's property, protect one's family, protect one's assets. And, you know, we see the history of the development of the gated community in California and how much it creates these walls between haves and have-nots, the emphasis that it puts on surveillance and security, the touchstone moment, of course, that was Trayvon Martin's murder in a gated community where he was not perceived as belonging in that community. So many bad spatial politics surrounding this. In Parable of the Sower, Lauren Olamina's gated community is protecting the family and her neighborhood against the threats, the mounting threats of a world where, as climate change and economic collapse drive increasingly extreme forms of poverty and then criminality, the gated community is literally keeping out these mobs of thieves and miscreants and, you know, no goodniks that are kind of banging at the gates of the community. And ultimately, you know, the family and Lauren are forced to flee the community because they can't keep that threatening outside world out anymore. So I think that's very telling about the way the rest of the novel unfolds around a band of survivors of this apocalyptic event that gather around Lauren and that make it their goal to travel to Northern California and to seek out a kind of new community, to build a new community sheltered away from the world. And it's a very, very interesting dynamic in the novel, because on the one hand, we see a physical environment that is rejecting not only the infrastructures of the state, right, collapsing freeways, towns crumbling into the sea, but is also kind of rejecting the property protective function of the state. We see the land kind of bucking off the idea that humans should be so invested in property. But that aside, it ends up being this very property and, you know, this is my land and I need to protect it kind of driven narrative.
That's the voice of Anne Stewart, and we are talking about her book, Angry Planet, Decolonial Fiction and the American Third World. We have a link to Anne's faculty page at the University of British Columbia, as well as to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. I'm C.S. Song. So Lauren and her band, right, they develop this ambition to build a new community called Acorn in the hills of Humboldt County in Northern California. So they're moving north along California's Highway 101. How do you interpret this ambition to create something anew as pretty much everything else falls away, falls apart? What is the political message or political valence you assign to this, and how much of it is determined, or how much does it take its cue from all the terrestrial and climate mayhem that Lauren and everybody else on the planet are witnessing?
For me, The environmental politics in this book have this really powerful message about a world where the angry planet is winning, right? In this novel, and the other novel in this chapter, Gerald Wilsner's Bear Heart, we see what happens when the angry planet fully fights back and state power collapses. Through that set of narrative conditions, we get an amazing environmental politics in which the survivors realize that they have to pay attention. The people who survive are those who realize, I have to pay attention to what the Earth is telling me right now. And one of the terms that I work with here heavily is the concept of terrestrial sovereignty. So the idea that the planet needs to be treated as its own independently acting and even political entity that has demands and has rights that it demand be respected by human actors. And so those who learn to respect it in this novel survive, and those who don't suffer the consequences. And there's even moments in the novel where Lauren and her band of travelers, they see a town that's being looted, and it's being looted as a fire has broken out because of an earthquake. And she says, I know that the fire and the earthquake drove these people to loot this town. She's noticing, oh, humans are reacting in this way. But for her, her response to the demand for sovereignty from the planet is to embrace a radical concept of change. And she actually starts a religion based on this that she calls Earthseed, right? That everything is change, everything is constant change. What the physical environment tells us is that we have to adapt and be responsive to that change. So that is the kind of environmental politics that shape her drive to go and, get away from the chaos of the collapsing state, go to Humboldt County, build this new community that respects this concept of change above all. And this philosophy is very, very consonant with a lot of terrific environmental politics. But the interesting little twist on it is that Lauren is also very disdainful of humans who cannot get on board with this new reality. And it is really the case throughout the novel that she almost feels that, and she's a leader of a post-apocalyptic band of survivors. She's got to be tough, but she does feel that people who cannot get on board with the new reality actually don't deserve to live. And so one of the things about the environmental politics in this novel, ultimately, that I argue, and this is a semi-unpopular, I think, argument, because Octavia Butler is wonderful and I love her work and she has tremendous fan base, but this is not a book that is written by someone who is particularly impressed by humans. And so it's actually one where we see some of the least amount of kind of revolutionary solidarity that we see in across Angry Planet fiction. And instead, we are introduced into a world, Lauren's world, where those who are not on board with the new environmental reality have no place in it. And the allyship comes from one's personal relationship to the physical environment rather than one's relationship to other humans, to other communities. And so the environmental politics here are one where one aligns themselves with the earth. And if others would like to share in that alignment, terrific. If not, you're on your own.
So stepping back and talking about kind of your book as a whole, your argument as a whole, your overarching argument, what is your book saying or claiming about the importance of land as maybe not just modeling revolutionary activity or prompting or encouraging human revolution toward a better world, a more just world. But the importance of the land as the foundation or source for human knowledge about humans' place in the world, about what it means to be human, about ways of understanding human and non-human being.
Thank you. That's a great question, and one that runs throughout the project and motivated so much of the theoretical framework for Angry Planet, because one of the things that fascinated me about this project was the resonances among the thinking of these different authors. And I theorize the shared stakes of their project, the ways that they think about the land as the base of knowledge of being in the world, and the point where we go to understand what it means to be human, as demonstrative of the correctness of this way of thinking, and one that is rooted in a lot of the early decolonial thought of the mid-20th century. And some major touchstone scholars for me here are folks like Sylvia Winter and George Manuel, who both made really compelling arguments for understanding decolonization is not something that is a matter of identity politics or recognition politics, but is an actual necessity for moving forward as a human society, moving forward with life on the planet. And their decolonial thinking is very much rooted in beginning with understanding the human relationship to the land and the way that that relationship shapes our understanding of what it means to be human in this very fundamental way. So we don't get to an understanding of what it actually means to exist as a global human community if we don't understand our relationship to the earth to begin with, and we don't understand the way that that relationship is fundamentally shaping some very, very basic ways of thinking in ways that I would go so far as to describe as inescapable. And so I think that kind of arriving at this conclusion, as the authors in these novels do, they create a very similar way of relating, like creating the narrative frameworks for their books, right? So they're creating the conditions of possibility for their characters based on the idea that the planet is this agentic, moving, and furious entity, and all the possibilities for what can happen to their characters, for what is possible for humans, comes from that original kind of base sense. And this is so important because so much of the stories that are told about being human in so much of our fiction and literature and film really curtail the possibilities for what particular actors in particular subject positions, where they're able to go, how they're able to move, what kind of trajectories, what kind of stories they can fit into. And so when we change the basic material conditions in which we're operating, we change the kind of stories we can tell about being human. And that is really what interests me in the idea of Angry Planet fiction.
And so is there some sort of ideal pointed toward or gestured toward, at least in some of these novels, as what a desirable, socially just, politically just way of being with people and the environment would be?
I do think that the ideal that these novels are all imagining their way toward, and even in, you know, the instances where humans are the villains in the story, that it is possible for human life to proceed in ways that allow us all to live in, and you know, this is another a quote from Glenn Sean Coulthard, who is such an important touchstone for this project, but for us to live in non-dominating and non-exploitative relations with each other and with the environment, which is the best promise of any decolonial futurity or imagination, and is certainly, as far as these novels and the thinkers in this project are concerned, what the Earth, what the planet is constantly telling us is the way to relate and to live and to find solidarity across differences as a necessary component of moving into a survivable, livable future.
10 novels are discussed and interpreted in my guest Anne Stewart's new book, Angry Planet, Decolonial Fiction and the American Third World. Anne teaches at the University of British Columbia. Anne, congratulations on the book, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, C.S. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you about the project.
And that interview was conducted on March 15th, 2024. And this is C.S., suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.